Glenn Winkler, KB7, LPW, and today's show is sponsored by Wallpaper World, Antennas West, Showtronics, and Ken Nichols of Linda Brock Auto Mall. Our guest in studio today is Al Gross, W8PAL, a man involved with personal use radio since the age of 9. We'll get to Al in a moment. I want to welcome you, though, to our studios before I get to my other stuff, and appreciate that you could be here today, Al. Our number is 241-1510. That's 241-1510 or 1-800-293-5366. And I suggest that you get in early if you want to talk to Al, because Mr. Gross has so many things that we're going to discuss that I think the lines may be tied up later. At least I hope that we get a lot of response. So again, 241-1510 or 1-800-293-KFNN. I want to thank those of you who've sent me in your QSL cards or postcards in the last week. I appreciate that. And all those out there who haven't yet done that, please send me a QSL card, or your non-ham, send me a postcard. Send it to Len Winkler, KFNN Radio, 4800 North Central, Phoenix, Arizona, 85012. And I'll send you back a KFNN KB7 LPW QSL card. And I'll also enter your card in our weekly drawing, and we'll give away a T-shirt later today. So send your card in. That's 4800 North Central, Phoenix, 85012. Last week at the Fort Tuttle Ham Fest, more than 600 license tests were administered. I think there were 400 and some people that took tests, and 624 tests in all were given. And they had a passing rate of a little over 60%. That's fantastic. This shows a renewed interest in ham radio, which is just super. And at DeVry yesterday, I was there. There seemed to be at least 100 or more people taking tests there. It's a great statement for the appeal of ham radio. At Fort Tuthill, approximately 6,000 people attended in the 3 days. And ARCA voted in Bill Crogham, WB0KSW, or Croham, I hope I didn't spell it or pronounce it wrong, the 1991 ARCA Ham of the Year. Bill has been responsible for training over 600 new hams in Tucson. He works with the Explorer Post in Tucson, and he's co-chairman of the FCC Interference Committee. Congratulations, Bill Crogham, WB0KSW, ARCA's 1991 Ham of the Year. I want to remind everyone that the ARRL Southwest Division Convention takes place October 11th, 12th, and 13th at the Safari Resort in Scottsdale. Everybody should definitely make plans to attend. There'll be exhibits, tech sessions, prizes. There'll be a swap meet. There'll be a Western steak dinner. There'll be a tour of Barry Goldwater's house, Ham Shack, and many, many other things. So don't forget, the Southwest Division Convention, October 11th, 12th, and 13th. I know everyone is impatient, waiting to hear Al, so we'll get to him in 1 second. Wallpaper World, with 6 great locations in the Valley, is the place to go for all your decorating needs. They give you the low price guarantee on any wallpaper you could possibly want. They carry 800 to 1,200 sample books in each store, along with 300 to 500 patterns in each store that you can take home with you, hang it immediately. And, of course, they carry all the tools, paste, and sundries you'll ever need. All their employees are trained. They're interior designers, so they can assist you in your selection. Just bring them a piece of a pillow, or bring a pillow, bring a piece of the fabric, bring a paint chip, and they'll match wallpaper and window treatments to you free of charge to whatever you need to fit your right decor. And all at the lowest prices anywhere. Remember, when it comes to window blinds and wood shutters, pleated shades, and vertical blinds, Wallpaper World manufactures them all in Phoenix for you, and all at the lowest prices, and of course, the best quality you can get anywhere. Give them a call tomorrow, Wallpaper World, with 6 locations in the Valley. 272-4788 is their number, 272-4788 for the location nearest you. Wallpaper World makes selecting decorating products an enjoyable experience. Al Gross, there's just so much to say about him. W8PAL, he's 73 years young, and he has done in his life quite a few amazing things. He's designed, invented, he's built things that we all know about and take for granted that they were always there. Al was first licensed as a ham I think that was, what, in 1933, and soon after, a couple years later, he built the first 300 megahertz quarter-watt walkie-talkie with a range of about 45 miles. There's so much to say about Al that really it'll take many shows to discuss all of it, and I think we will, you know, if he's allows us, we'll have him back again. But what I'd like to do today is basically go over a history of Al Gross and what his accomplishments have been through the years. And if you have out there any questions about a particular thing that we bring up, a particular event, just give us a call, 241-1510 or 1-800-293-5366, and we'll spend time talking about that particular thing. As you'll find, when Al starts talking, he likes to talk and tell us about it. So don't be afraid to ask him questions. In upcoming segments, we can talk about specific events, but today we'll just talk chronological. I'm thrilled to have you here today, Al, and tell us how you first became interested in radio after you say hello to your wife and her sister.
Well, I'll say hello to Ethel and Laurie, but my days in radio began when I was 9 years old, and my parents took my sister and I to Buffalo, New York, aboard a Great Lakes steamboat. And in those days, that was an easy way to commute between cities if you were on the Great Lakes. And during the course of the trip, I had an opportunity to roam around the boat or the ship, and I wandered up to the top deck, and I heard noises that sounded very much like static crashes. And here I came across the open door to the radio room, and I saw inside the radio operator with the headphones on his ears and tapping out code with a spark gap transmitter. And he took me into the room, showed me what he had, and believe it or not, he bought me a sandwich. We were very close to lunch, and I proceeded to spend a good part of the afternoon being indoctrinated into radio, and that's what started my course in radio.
And then you got your first crystal set.
Yes, I began with a crystal set, and it took a lot of pennies in those days to accumulate the money to buy it. I managed to put up an aerial, and I got a pair of earphones, and away I went listening to radio. But believe it or not, my crystal set was very sensitive, and I was able to hear the lower part of the 160-meter band, which at that time was just above the broadcast band. Uh-huh. And that fascinated me because I heard ham talk.
And what year are we talking about?
We're talking now about 1930.
Okay.
And that fascinated me on what these fellows were saying in an impromptu way. It was not like a broadcast.
If there's anybody out there who remembers 1930 and also had a crystal radio, want to relive some memories with Al, give us a call. Okay, go ahead, Al.
Well, anyway, I was curious enough to learn who that particular amateur radio operator was that I was listening to. He was very strong. And he had given his address to another amateur over the air, and I made a point to visit this particular amateur. Mm-hmm. And it was at that time that I really became fascinated with radio enough to want to pursue it first as a hobby.
Okay. And then, okay, so you were now getting into the hobby of it, and you, of course, probably were one who didn't just accept the crystal radio as such, took it all apart, put it back together about, what, a million times?
Oh, yes. I did all kinds of tricks to find out how I can increase the sensitivity, how I can get the tuning range much wider, because after I visited this amateur radio operator, I discovered that there were many more frequencies that I could listen to, but unfortunately, I didn't have the gear that he had to do it. Mm-hmm. And I had to find my way into junkyards to find old radio sets in order to get the parts to build a 1-tube radio set.
And now, from what we discussed earlier, you weren't exactly being brought up by two nuclear scientists, is that correct? I mean, you didn't come from a background like that, so you were doing this all on your own.
Yes, my parents were very poor. My father was a tailor, my mother was a seamstress, and, of course, my sister was younger than me, and she wasn't interested in radio at all, so I had to do this all my own. And what little I could learn in school, and I went to the libraries to get books on radio. There weren't very many books on the subject at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to sort of pull my way through it by doing all the experimental work and then reading what I could from the books until I learned the technical language of the necessary formulas that are needed to calculate frequency, wavelength, and the technical part of it was very hard to learn at that time.
So you really were self-taught?
In a way, yes. Because many of the experiments that I did at home in my little radio shack in the basement, sometimes I would ask my science teacher answers to questions that they couldn't answer, and I searched very diligently and hard to get those answers.
Okay, well now, so you, that was like 1930, you said, so now you spent a few years groping, learning, practicing, and then the next major development, you put together what?
I put together a 2-3-tube radio, and also the beginnings of my first transmitter, which was a 1-tube oscillator.
Uh-huh.
And I learned quickly that I had to get an amateur radio license in order to get on the air to talk, because this amateur told me that I had to learn the code, and at that time I had to learn at 13 words a minute, and I had to learn the technical language that would be embraced in the FCC tests, unlike today, which is much easier because now it's a true or false statement, 5 words a minute if you're lucky enough to learn that, and then they have other classes of licenses that are very easy today. But in those days, for a 11, 12, or 13-year-old, it was extremely difficult.
And so you got your license in, I think it was 1933?
Yes.
And you were, what, about 13 or 14?
14.
14 years old. Okay. Now we get to about, what, 1938, and you put together a walkie-talkie.
Well, when I became an amateur radio operator and I learned that I can build things that would transmit and receive, and I learned very well, I discovered that my great interest was to be able to build things that you could carry with you, that would be portable. I enjoyed taking things out and taking batteries along with me to a park and being able to operate portable.
What kind of batteries did they have back then?
Oh, they were much larger than what we have today. The batteries would weigh quite a few pounds.
They didn't have the gold tips, huh?
No, they didn't have that at all. And it was fascinating because as the technology grew from year to year, I improved on my designs until I discovered that I can build things small enough and at high frequencies enough to make them truly portable. And at the time that I was doing all this work, frequencies above 100 megahertz were experimental. And I had already designed transmitters and receivers that would operate well above those ranges of between 2 and 400 megahertz at that time. There were no allocations set aside for transmitters and receivers at the time, so it was all experimental, and you can operate where you want. I was capable and able to design a small handheld walkie-talkie that would transceive or act as a receiver and transmitter at 300 megahertz.
Wow.
Okay. And measuring those frequencies were extremely difficult in those days. I used a meter stick to do it.
Okay.
A lot of people say, well, how did he do that with a meter stick?
Well, I would have that question.
Well, there's a method whereby that can be done, and I learned to do it, and I learned to measure frequencies very crudely, but it did that way.
And this little walkie-talkie had about a quarter watt, 45?
It had about a quarter watt of energy, of RF energy that it put out, and it was a very sensitive receiver. And the best range I was able to get at that time from two tall buildings in Ohio was about 45 miles.
That's pretty good range.
Between two sets of the same order.
And they had vacuum tubes in it. I know I saw you.
Yes.
Those are
vacuum tubes.
Go ahead.
And incidentally, vacuum tube theory in today's solid state theory is a very interesting thing because they're not related to one another. So I had to learn vacuum tube theory to understand more what I was doing as I grew older, and that I did.
Okay, let's do a trivia question right now and see how many people out there can answer this one. It's not really that difficult, but you know, it's an electronic theory, I guess. Not electronic theory. What would you call it?
It's an ordinary question that most anyone in even slightly familiar with electronics, even the layman would understand it.
Okay, our number is 241-1510 or 1-800-293-5366. And Al, let's hear the trivia question.
Many years ago, a crystal set was used as a radio receiver. What would that crystal set be technically called today?
Okay, so what would we call a crystal set today? It's not that easy, not that difficult. Our phone number, 241-1510 or 1-800-293-5366. In the meantime, I looked at all the ads in the paper yesterday for new and used cars. There were a million of them, or more. There might even have been more than a million. Each was supposedly outdoing the other. One was giving you double the trade-in value. Another had humongous rebates, and still another offered to triple my down payment. Amazing, they're going to triple my down payment. Confusing is the understatement of the year on these ads. I wish somebody would invent a new way, sort of like Al Gross inventing, a new way of buying a car or truck. Well, you know, it's finally happened, and no, Al Gross wasn't the inventor of this one. He didn't do that. But a no-hassles approach to buying a new or used vehicle, a place to buy where the person takes care of you and actually cares about you, a price you need not haggle for hours over, actually a fun place to buy, has been invented. The invention? Well, that's Ken Nichols, WA7HXZ, the fleet manager for Linda Brock Auto Mall. Ken treats you the same way he wants to be treated. He explains, not pushes, the good and bad points of a particular vehicle. Linda Brock stocks BMWs, Oldsmobiles, Volkswagens, and Dodge. But Ken doesn't stop there. He'll get you any new vehicle that you want, and all at the lowest prices anywhere. And remember, don't forget about Ken Nichols when you want a used car, because he has a tremendous, tremendous selection of those also. He sells cars to people all over the United States for only two reasons, price and service. He has special savings plans with Allied Signal Corp, Motorola Credit Union, BF Goodrich, the Gosnell Building Company, Dillard's, and many more. And they all get involved with Ken Nichols for the same two reasons, the best service and the absolute best price. Just this week, one customer, a butcher, gave Ken 2 pounds of sausage that he prepared because he was so pleased with service he got from Ken. I mean, people are always giving Ken stuff because of the service and the price that they get. They are so pleased. I mean, it's really amazing. You'll be pleased also. Savings of $2,000 and more over other dealers' best price is what some other hams have said. So call Ken Nichols today, 228-2336, 228-2336. In truth, you will pay fleet prices with no hassles with Ken Nichols, 228-2336. Tell Ken Len Winkler sent you in, and don't forget to get your free Linda Brock cap. And oh yes, remember to mention Ham Radio and More, and you will receive 15% off parts and labor when you have your car serviced at Linda Brock. So call Ken Nichols today. Well, we have a winner on the line. Let's go to that. Robert Rice, K7HVV.
Hi.
Welcome to Ham Radio and More.
Thank you, Len. How'd your daughter do yesterday?
You want to bring up a sad point.
<Get it>.
She missed by 2 questions.
Oh, that's too bad.
But she is not a quitter, and what Robert's talking about is a 9-year-old, my 9-year-old daughter, who has been studying for her tech, and she did take the test yesterday, and she passed the novice portion of the NOCO, but she hasn't passed the tech portion.
Well, we were rooting for her.
I know, I appreciate it. I really appreciate it, and so does she, all the support, and I got to say, all the smiles that some of you guys had when she walked up there and gave her information. She was, you know, a little bit nervous, as any child would be. So she'll pass it, though, at DeVry in September, or she'll pass it when the Scottsdale Club has their testing later on in the month.
Yeah, sure hope so.
But anyway, what is the answer to a crystal set, what we'd call it today?
Well, the term is a semiconductor device, a tuned radio frequency semiconductor circuit.
sounds good to me. And do you want to elaborate on that, Al?
Well, he made it much broader than we really needed, but semiconductor is good enough.
Okay. Well, Robert, what you're going to get is from Antennas West in Provo, Utah, 100 free QSL cards. And everybody needs QSL cards, and so we'll get Robert Rice, K7HVV, at the address you gave, if that's correct.
Right.
Okay, and we'll get you 100 QSL cards out, and we appreciate you listening and participating.
Thank you, Len.
Thank you for calling. 73s. Okay. Al, now we got this walkie-talkie made in 1941, and then...
Of course, we could have added a cat's whisker to the semiconductor, but he failed to elucidate on that, but that's
then,
all right.
Then you said something about a galena or something.
Well, the original semiconductor was a galena crystal.
Okay.
Which is still used today for crystal sets.
Okay, well... When we get to 1942 in World War II, that's when you really start strutting your stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, what happened was there was a little publicity on the handheld walkie-talkie that I had at the time, and it appeared in several magazines with pictures. And at the start of World War II, in 1942, I received a call from Washington, D.C., from a person who was associated with the Office of Strategic Services, which after the war became known as CIA. However, he wanted me to come to Washington to demonstrate the walkie-talkies for the members of the Office of Strategic Services. Mm-hmm. And I packed up two sets, went to Washington, and demonstrated the devices, and there was a profound interest in it, particularly after they decided they were going to try an experiment which included talking from a lightweight airplane to ground, and that proved very successful. Mm-hmm. It was that experiment and that little test that got me involved with the Office of Strategic Services for a special project.
And that is the Joan and Eleanor project.
That was codenamed Joan Eleanor by the Office of Strategic Services. The equipment on the ground had Eleanor, and the equipment in the plane would be called Joan. The equipment in the plane looked very much like the conventional CB radio that you have today, or some of the smaller ham sets that you have today. And along with it was a wire recorder to record the messages that were transmitted from ground to the plane. And the principle behind that was, at that time, the President of the United States wanted to get information very quickly from occupied countries so that he would be on par with the information that Churchill was getting in England. And the purpose of this was primarily to get intelligence quickly. So Joan Eleanor turned out to be one of the classic methods for clandestine operation behind enemy lines.
Well, I have some articles, and we're not going to get too deep into this because we can spend a couple hours just on this, but an article which involves Al quite strongly is entitled The Spy Radio That Became CB, and it talks about the clandestine operations. You were telling me that in Youngstown, Ohio, us.
Well, in order to make the sets, at that time, I was requested by the OSS to find a place where they could be manufactured secretly. The project was classified top secret, and the closest place I can find to Cleveland, Ohio, where I resided at the time, was Youngstown, Ohio, because at that time the War Production Board deemed it impossible to set up any new operation of any kind in Cleveland, Ohio, because it was a heavy industrialized city. Youngstown was better equipped for our purpose, and it was all done in a clandestine sort of way, of course, in an old house that was refurbished right next to a machine shop, because I needed a machine shop to do it. So the owner of the machine shop had no idea what was going on in the house, but it was in the house that we refurbished and made a little manufacturing operation out of it, and the sets were built there, and they were transported to Washington, to the OSS, by railroad, personally by myself, and about 600 sets were made at the time.
That's great, and if it wasn't for that, we may not have won the war so quickly.
Well, according to many of the reports that were written by others, including members that were commissioned after the war to write the history of the OSS, it was one of the most spectacular and best operations of clandestine communications during World War II.
What would be really neat if somebody was out there that actually used one of these and was in World War II. Now, that would be kind of neat.
That would be true.
If there's anybody out there that used one of these devices, was involved in that, I'd certainly like to hear from you, as would Al. 241-1510 or 1-800-293-5366. Okay. Let's go a few more years.
Well, we want to stick to the tail end of the war.
Okay, go ahead.
Because it was during that time, the Federal Communications Commission had an organization called the Radio Intelligence Division of the FCC. The Radio Intelligence Division was operated by the chief engineer of the commission, who was a ham radio operator. His name was George Sterling. George managed to see the sets during a meeting we had on a frequency spectrum space in Washington, D.C., and the spectrums that were being used by the services. It was during one of these meetings that I showed Sterling the walkie-talkies, and he was so fascinated by the smallness and size of the set that he proposed showing it to the entire commission staff, which included the chairman of the commission. This was done late in 1944, and the commissioners were delighted to see that there was such technical progress at the time that several of them suggested the idea of personal two-way radio after World War II. Mm-hmm. This was the true genesis of what we have today in personal two-way radio, cellular radio, and, of course, radio paging. I was asked to demonstrate this to the commission at the time, and the beginning of 1945, a demonstration was given in a closed session with the full membership of the entire commission and the chairman of the commission, and two members, Commissioner E.K. Jack Jett and Roswell Hyde, and also the chairman, Charles Denny, who later on became a member of RCA, decided that this was something that the commission wanted to pursue. In July of 1945, which was a month before the termination of World War II, Commissioner Jack Jett wrote an article, Phone Me by Air, that appeared in Saturday Evening Post magazine, and this was the first public exposure of the commission's version of what they called the Citizens Radio Communication Service for the public, which would be any person 18 years of age or older could operate in this new spectrum that they were going to set aside for personal radio.
And that was 450 to 460 megahertz.
450, 460 megahertz. And in 1947, at the World Telecommunication Conference in Atlantic City, 80 nations agreed that that would be the allocation they would set aside for that purpose. So it was universally agreed that that spectrum would be allocated for that purpose.
Now, in 1946, well, of course, you were already the father of Citizens Band Radio. I mean, we know.
Well, the connotation... the first initial thought was it would be a form of citizens radio. It was really personal radio, but citizens, you had to be 18 years of age and a citizen of the United States.
But now you won't take responsibility for what goes on 11 meters now, though, right?
Not really.
Okay. In 1946, you started your own company.
In Cleveland, Ohio, to manufacture the first personal radios for CB. And I was fortunate enough to get a large mass merchandiser in Chicago to be interested in this, and I had not yet received type approval of any sets because it was agreed that the first sets would have to be type approved by the FCC for use by the public. Even today, equipment must be approved for certain applications by the commission.
And you you sold 25,000 of them, I see, in 1949. That's a fair amount.
Yeah, that's right. That was at $75 a piece. 25,000 makes a lot of money. And also, the U.S. Coast Guard came along very shortly thereafter and ordered another 500 at frequencies set aside by them slightly lower than 400 megahertz.
And what were you selling those walkie-talkies for? What were they going to be selling for in the store?
$179.50 a pair.
That's a lot of money back then.
Those days, that's right.
But you got two of them. And
that's
they transmitted on a particular frequency?
They would operate only on 465 megahertz at that time. That was the frequency set aside just for the handheld units. The band was allocated for both fixed and mobile, mm-hmm. but those were set aside for the center of the band. Today, that spectrum still has, eight channels dedicated for personal radio use, but you require commercial FM equipment for it, and it can be used for personal two-way radio.
Well, then you came up in 1948 or 49 with a two-meter commercial radio.
Yes. There was a lot of interest in portable mobile radios, and I designed a transceiver which was not too much different than what you have today, which was not crystal control, but it had a very stable transmitter in it. And later I had a crystal controlled system that went with it, and I made about 11,000-12,000 of those before the popularity disappeared.
Okay. All right. Now, kind of interesting, in 1948 you were sitting in your office, and a gentleman by the name of Chester Gould came over there and was talking to you, and I guess you had something sitting on your desk that he thought was kind of interesting, although it didn't make a bunch of, the story.
Well, 1948 is a unique year because March 22, 1948, the FCC announced officially at the Institute of Radio Engineers Convention in New York City the first type approval of a CB radio or a personal radio to my company, which was called Citizens Radio Corporation. And that's when I received that large order, incidentally. But in the meantime, I received a lot of publicity worldwide. And during the course of 1948, a cartoonist called me on the telephone. His name was Chester Gould. And he was the cartoonist for the Dick Tracy cartoon character. And he wanted to see the portable radios that I had, with the idea he might want to use them in his comic strip. And on my table, when he visited me, I had a small wrist FM transmitter, which I could put on my wrist. And I demonstrated this to him. And he liked that idea. And several months later, had telephoned me, and he asked me if he could use the idea, and I had no objection. And October of 1948, Dick Tracy was equipped with his first wrist radio.
I think that's a fascinating story. And I know you made a fortune from giving him that idea, right? No.
Zero.
Zero. Well, at least you can sleep at night knowing that you came up with it. I think that's great.
That was also the genesis of the wireless microphone, by the way. That was a wireless microphone.
I want everybody to know that one of the big things here is that you got to understand that Al is a amateur radio operator, and all these things come from the fact that he is an amateur radio operator, and ham radio is still, there's so many things still to be explored and invented, and this just shows what ham radio has done for the history of radio. Anyway, and, you know, to get into the comics and all that, that's kind of interesting. And I've had the pleasure of being able to see these products Al brought to me, and I just touching them is unbelievable to look at them. They're just magnificent. Okay. Shep, WD6EOY, welcome to Ham Radio and More.
Hi, Len. How are you?
Pretty good. And how are you today?
Good.
What can we do for you?
Well, I'd like to say a few words about the amateur radio spectrum bill, actually two bills that are up before the House and the Senate currently.
Okay, let's take a moment and talk about that. I discussed it with Al, and he's extremely in favor of this, too, so go ahead.
Okay, first of all, in the way of background, I know most of us are aware of the fact that we lost several megahertz of the 220 spectrum recently, and as you know, the ARRL has gone to court against the FCC to try to get that reversed, and so far that has been less than successful. I think kind of netting it all out, we have a choice. We can either continue to try to fight the FCC and go to court and spend a lot of money and with no gain, or we can, as an alternative, attempt to get these bills through the House and the Senate. And what it really requires is about an hour of each of our time to send letters to our senator and to our representative. That would be McCain and DeConcini, and Rhodes, Kyle, and Colby in the House. Bob Stump is already a supporter of the bill.
Okay. Do you want to give addresses out? Do you want me to give them? I have addresses. Would you like to pursue from this?
The simplest way to do this is to send it to the U.S. Senate in the case of McCain and DeConcini, and that's the SHOB, which is the Senate Office Building, Washington, D.C., and the zip code is 30510. -0302, and the House of Representatives is CHOB. That's the House Office Building.
And everybody should write it if they can in their own handwriting or a typed letter that they themselves write up.
Yes. The other thing I'd suggest each of you do is read the recent QST article, page 48 and 49. And in there, it states the it has the sample letters that you can write, and also the addresses.
Well, I do know that just looking at the, I have the bill in front of me, and at the end of it, it does say the FCC shall not diminish existing allocations of spectrum to the amateur radio service after January 1st, 1991. The FCC shall provide equivalent replacement spectrum to the amateur radio service for any frequency reallocation after January 1st, 1991. Now, I know some people might have a problem with the way that's worded, but it's better than we have now.
Well, as I said earlier, when we have a choice, we can either take what we've got or we can try to get the allocation of our bands overturned in court. And I'd certainly there's really two parts to these bills, and there's two bills, one in the House and one in the Senate, and their wordings are about the same. And there's really two parts to it. One is to ensure that hams can continue to operate the spectrums as they now use them. And if not, that means that if they are taken away, that replacement bands of equal in both size and characteristics must be given to us.
Okay, will you be at the Scottsdale Amateur Radio Club meeting Wednesday evening?
I plan to, yes.
Okay, well, I encourage everybody, not just to push the Scottsdale Club meeting, but I encourage everybody to come there, and I'm sure you'll, I would imagine you're going to have some of these letters that you brought to the DX meeting last week?
Yes, I will.
Okay, so I encourage everybody to come to that meeting. I mean, if you're a member or not, come on by and pick up one of these letters if you need some help on writing it, because Shep has done an excellent job here. I don't know if you wrote it or however it came up, but these are dear representative as a concerned voter in Arizona, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think if you take the time to copy this and send one to each of the to the Senate and to the House of Representatives, we need to do something. And I know, Al, you would agree, right?
I agree.
Okay, that's short and distinct. Okay.
But there, you know, the ways of getting to this thing through the FCC and through Congress and Senate is a very difficult path to take. And you have to show cause for retaining frequencies in a very discreet manner. Those are some of the elements that have to be examined from the legalistic point of view. There's the ways in which it can be done to make it look like it would provide a severe impact on society in general as well as ham radio. That's what you got to do.
Okay. Any other input, Shep, otherwise?
Well, just to kind of add to his comments, there are some very important points in these letters that I think need to be stated, and this is kind of expanding on the letters that are recommended in QST. First of all, there are 9,791 amateurs in the state of Arizona and over 500,000 nationally. Another fact that I think our senators and representatives should be aware of is that hams passed 500,000 messages and facilitated over, I think it was 140,000 phone patches during the Gulf crisis.
Well, we had Robert Sutton, the chief of Army MIRS, on about 5 weeks ago, and he definitely responded about that and talked about that. And we also read a letter from General Schwarzkopf that was written to him explaining how much he thanked us hams for helping in the Desert Storm and allowing all that traffic to get through from the soldiers on the front lines in Saudi and Iraq, obviously, to talk to their loved ones here in the United States. So, and 95%, I guess, of MIRS is made up of ham radio operators.
Sure. Well, that those kinds of facts clearly presented to our congressmen and representatives, along with the fact of the assistance of ham radio in national disasters, and of course. Also, a very important topic nowadays is its contribution to the education of our youth. All of our astronauts in the next to last shuttle were hams.
And next, go ahead.
Anyway, I think these are points that need to be out. It's all in the letters, and I've certainly got copies available if we'd like to use them.
Okay. Well, I thank you very much for calling, and I recommend people to go to the Scottsdale Club meeting on Wednesday, and I know you'll talk further on it.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Len. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome. Thank you for calling. Bye-bye. Okay. I need to get another thing here. Let's see. As you know, a ham is never satisfied with what they have, and I'm no different than anybody else. We're always looking to improve. So during the week, I went to Showtronics and purchased a new keyboard for my computer. It works great, and it sure seems to improve the speed of my typing. if anybody contacts me on Packet, which I spend a lot of time, you'll see that this new keyboard has enabled me to send back a message quicker. You can get all the things you want from Showtronics, from a small accessory to an entire new system. In fact, just this week, Showtronics has received in their new shipment of 386 40 megahertz computers. And boy, is this a fast computer. This is a must-see. Super fast and really super priced. Remember, Showtronics is famous for their absolutely free beginning classes on computers, which are given every Saturday afternoon by the president, Al Shope. He'll go over the stuff that you need to know to get started in computers. And on Tuesdays, he gives you a slightly advanced class. Absolutely free. And I mean, it's like 4 or 5 hour classes, which are free. It's worth a lot of money. You got to call in advance, though, to register, as space is limited and it sure fills up quickly. Remember, too, if you stop into Showtronics, just mention Ham Radio and More, and you'll receive free a box of computer diskettes. What have you got to lose? So go to Showtronics, test drive one of their 15 systems that are up and running. Buy a book, a computer, a monitor, or upgrade your present system like I've been doing and save big money. I'm very, very satisfied. They beat all prices on items that they have in stock. They'll beat anybody else's price. Showtronics, 1831 West Rose Garden Lane, north of Bell Road, off of 19th Avenue. And their phone number, 256-2266, 256-2266. Showtronics, the more you know about computers, the better Showtronics looks. Stop in today. They're open 7 days a week for your convenience. And tell them you heard about them on Ham Radio and More. Now, we only have about 16 minutes left, and we haven't even touched on, we haven't even got to 1950 yet. In 1950, you designed the first digital one-way radio paging system, or the beeper, as I guess we know of it today.
That's right. I was approached by a hospital consultant from New York who wanted to know if it was possible to produce a system whereby you can page silently doctors and nurses in hospitals. He had already seen the publicity on the walkie-talkie, so he knew it. There was electronics that could be made small, and I was given a contract to come up with the idea, and that year I produced a two-tone digital radio paging transmitter and a little tiny receiver which you could carry on your belt like you do today that would page doctors and nurses. A year later, demonstrating that in Philadelphia at a hospital association convention, I was surprised to learn that nobody was interested in the idea.
It was too cumbersome for them to hold it on their belt, huh?
Well, no, it was very lightweight and it was unique, but they didn't want to dispense with the loudspeaker system, and doctors failed to recognize its capability because they said it would interfere with their golf practice.
You were ahead of your time.
I guess so.
I skipped something that of interest. Tell me about proximity fuses.
Oh, towards the tail end of the war, because of the work that I had been doing in miniaturization, because the set was very, very small at that time, I got called in by the National Bureau of Standards in Washington, who were interested in building a device that would sense aircraft or a missile, and upon approach, it would cause the ordnance to explode, which would be not too different than a garage door opener idea. And that was the genesis of some early versions of proximity fuses that I designed and built for the military.
Okay, and you brought in one that you showed me that fit on, what, a 40?
A 40-millimeter shell. Uh-huh. And, of course, I have other models that fit onto larger bombs, and unfortunately I couldn't bring those in because they'd be too heavy to carry.
Okay.
But during the war over in the southeast, in the Persian Gulf, against Iraq, proximity fuses were used along with laser-guided weapons.
Is that what's called the smart bomb? Is that anything like?
Much smarter. It makes the target look bigger to the weapon.
Okay.
That's the theory behind it.
In 1955, I'm going to move along quicker here. In 1955, U.S. Patent Court, in a unanimous decision, awarded you the priority of invention of the handheld walkie-talkie.
That's right.
So, I mean, that's as legitimate as you can get, right?
When you get a three-judge opinion like that, there's no need to contest the argument any further. There were other patents involved, but the primary patent for the handheld was in contest at that time.
Okay, and you designed, developed, manufactured proximity fuses for the U.S. Army, and these fuses were immune to electromagnetic countermeasures. What does that mean?
That meant that you couldn't use radar or electromagnetic devices similar to radar to cause an early burst or cause them to malfunction. They were immune to electromagnetic radiation. They would only sense the charge that's produced by frictional electricity that was on the aircraft or on the missile.
And then in 1960, the Department of the Army Ordnance Corp. Harry Diamond Laboratory successfully test-fired the special proximity fuse of your design and manufacture.
That's right, yeah, and it worked very well.
Okay. We have about 12 minutes. We'll still be able to take your calls, 241-1510 and 1-800-293-5366. I have to believe that most of you people are entranced out there and don't call. If we get a lot of calls, we might be able to spend another few minutes after the hour. So don't hesitate to call if you have any questions for Al. Okay, then there are just so many things. Let's talk about the electric field meter that you're talking about on
the proximity fuse worked on a principle of measuring electric fields, not magnetic fields like those that affect compasses and this sort of phenomena. What my device does, it measures an electric field, a static electric field, and it measures the perturbation created by other objects as well as the characteristics of the surrounding environment. And during the time that I was working on the fuse, I was also designing a sensor that would measure environmental electrical effects such as clouds and thunderstorms.
Okay. Okay, we have another call. And I have been given, I've just handed a notice, I've been given permission to continue on the show past the 3 o'clock hour if we get phone calls. So if people do have questions, Al Gross has agreed to stay on longer. And if you do have questions about any of these things we're talking about, by all means, give us a call. Okay, here we go. Okay, Jim, KA7BGY, welcome to Ham Radio and More.
BGY out here in Apache Junction.
Okay, Jim.
Last week you said that nobody announced Ham Awareness Day. Let you know that the Superstition Club has set September 22nd as Ham Awareness Day at the VF Factory Outlet on Baseline. And that's about it. I am very interested in this program today, and I, when it says just a few minutes more, I was... wanted to get in on it, but I'm glad that you are going to continue, because I'm going to be listening. I'm really enjoying it. So thanks a lot, Len.
Well, thank you, Jim. Any special type of events that you're going to have at the Awareness Day?
Well, we have all day over at the VF Outlet. We will be having our fall meeting. We'll be starting in September at the Velda Rose Church. We have our Ham Fest on the last day of November, but... I see you out there sooner or later. I know I met you at the breakfast we had last spring there. In fact,
right.
About the first time you had a program on.
That's correct. Well, I appreciate you calling in, and I'm happy to hear that you guys are doing something for the Awareness Day. I, again, would appreciate if other clubs would let me know what they're going to do for the Ham Awareness Day. So you'll have it at the VF Factory Outlet, and I think that's at what, Superstition Springs Road and the freeway?
Val Vista and Baseline.
Oh, Val Vista and Baseline. Okay, Val Vista and Baseline. I thank you for that.
Okay, man.
Keep listening. Thank you, Jim. Bye-bye. Okay, in 1978, I have here, I thought this was kind of interesting, that, Al, you were honored in a magazine article by Peter Bowles, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, and what he said is their inventions tipped the scales in World War II, and without them there would be no personal radio. Tell us, because it was about you and somebody else by the name of Fred Link. Tell us a little about Fred Link.
Yes, Fred Link was involved with building FM equipment, which was very, very new during World War II, and his equipment successfully demonstrated the mobile use of FM radio on tanks and on vehicles, which were static-free. FM, as everybody's supposed to know, is relatively static-free reception. And its application to two-way communications at that time was quite new, and Link was instrumental in producing mobile equipment that would work very well. His activity was recognized as having established reasonably moderate ranges of communications in occupied countries and places where we were invading with our forces during World War II. On the other hand, my equipment was used in a clandestine way to acquire information and intelligence that the president wanted at that time, and very many important events that took place during the war in war operations and battle orders were carried on with the sets that I built.
Okay. And now you were telling me earlier about putting a, that you were one of the first ones, or you were the first one to put a television camera on a Delta rocket to see the stages or something?
We're getting a little further ahead.
Okay,
we've got to come back to the electric field meter.
Okay, let's go
business.
Back to that. I'm sorry.
When I had been working on the proximity fuse, that worked on this principle, I was also designing sensors that could be used for this particular phenomena, measuring this phenomena. And the Air Force and some of the government agencies were very much interested in applying this to large missiles like the Atlas, the Titan, and also the Saturn rocket. with the idea of measuring electrification during the missile launch. These were successfully used on a number of large ICBMs from launch through reentry, and the success of those missions proved the value of these sensors. And during the Apollo mission, two of these sensors were planted on the moon for measuring electric fields, the moon's environment, more or less. Mm-hmm. And subsequently, NASA now uses these now at Cape Kennedy to measure electrification of the environment prior to launch of space shuttles and other vehicles.
Okay, and so it's you have some equipment that's on the moon working today.
Two electric field meters measuring the Earth's or rather the moon's electric field environment.
Okay, and is there someone who's getting this information? I mean, at this point,
well, it's being telemetered back, and of course, Jet Propulsion Lab is the recipient of a lot of this information.
Well, you're presently employed at Orbital Sciences Corporation.
I'm an electrical engineer with Orbital Science Corporation Space Data Division in Chandler.
And you're what are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on some satellite projects. One satellite project will be looking at the Earth's environment, looking at the certain characteristics of the ocean, and also on vehicles for launching smaller satellites into low orbits. And here, about a month ago, our company had a very successful flight of the Pegasus launch vehicle, which is dropped from a B-52 aircraft, and then the rockets, of course, propel it up into a low orbit.
And that's supposed to start sending payloads that the shuttle's doing now, as I was reading somewhere.
Smaller payloads, uh-huh. But effective payloads.
Okay, let me do this in the last couple of minutes. I talked to Jim Stevens, KK7C, from Antennas West during the week, and Jim arrived back in Provo, Utah, safe and sound, thankfully. He and I want to thank each of you for the tremendous response you gave him. His HF antenna seminar was such a success that he had to put on a second one later in the afternoon Saturday. The first one lasted about three times longer than he initially scheduled it for. What a super response. And I personally want to thank each of you for mentioning this show to him. I really appreciate it. Jim sold almost all of his 200 tiger tails that he brought, the most at any ham fest that he's ever gone to. You guys do listen, and again, we both thank you. Jim will be at the Southwest Division Convention in October with another seminar on Saturday morning, and all are, of course, encouraged to attend. When it comes to any type of antenna, or needing new QSL cards, or solar power supplies or panels, or quick-launch antenna products, or the new handy-talky hands-free pouch, Antennas West is the place to call. Jim Stevens is always willing to answer your every question and steer you in the right direction. And if you're one of the few that either didn't make it to Tud Hill or still don't have your own tiger's tail, give Jim a call and order one. They really work, no joke. They'll increase your HT's output and receive from 2 to 4 dB. Even John Moore, NJ7E, bought his own tiger's tail. So give Jim Stevens and Antennas West a call today. 1-800-926-7373. 1-800-926-7373. Be sure to mention this show for a special discount. Well, we haven't gotten a bunch of phone calls, and so unless we get 50 of them, like right now, we're going to close at 3 o'clock and come back at some time in the future with Al Gross. We only really touched the tip of the iceberg, and I really appreciated Al coming here, and we will do it again because I think there's so many things that we just didn't touch on. I think everybody's out there listening, and we should get some response during the week. Thank you, Al.
And thank everybody for listening.
Send in your QSL card to 4800 North Central, Phoenix, Arizona. And again, this is KB7 LPW, Len Winkler. We'll see you next week. 73s.